I am so thrilled today to be speaking about biomimicry, a design discipline that seeks sustainable solutions by emulating nature's patterns and strategies. My two guests today are New Mexicans who each work with biomimicry. Toby Herzlich is a leadership trainer and facilitator. She's been a consultant to progressive not-for-profit organizations here in New Mexico, nationally and internationally, for about 25 years. She is now a certified biomimicry specialist and has recently started Biomimicry for Social Innovation, applying nature's wisdom to questions of how we can grow life-affirming organizations. Also with us is Chris Calori, an Albuquerque architect. Her desire to live in a more sustainable world led her to environmental building consulting and the field of biomimicry. She's an adjunct professor at the University of New Mexico and utilizes biomimicry thinking to inform more meaningful design solutions. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Toby and Chris. I'm so glad to have you both here.
Thanks for having us, Aileen. It's great to be here.
So biomimicry, for people who are not really familiar with the term, bios, meaning life, and mimesis, meaning imitate, is, as I said, a discipline that seeks to sustainable solutions by emulating nature's time-tested patterns. So basically it means it's the idea that a sustainable world already exists, and we have to look at the value of nature to try to recreate these patterns in the way we live our life. Can you tell us a little bit more about it and the emergence of the field of biomimicry?
Sure. Well, biomimicry as a field was named initially by a woman named Janine Benyus, who wrote a book about 15 years ago called Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature. And she was a nature writer and a scientist, a biologist, and had been wondering, is there anybody out there who's looking at these amazing strategies from the natural world and applying them to their inventions? And she started asking that question and looking around and realizing that actually it was happening in so many places. So her book was investigating that, and since she wrote that book about 15 years ago, the field has completely blossomed. There's lots and lots of people who are turning to the natural world and studying how would nature do what they're trying to do in the fields of engineering, architecture, as Chris can tell you about, design, all kinds of things that have to do with how we make our world and how we can make our world in a more sustainable way. And since then, there's been not only a field blossoming, but a whole network of people who are doing this work, including Chris and I here in New Mexico and many other folks around the world. Janine Benyus and her team have started a company and a nonprofit that do consulting and education. There's more than 30 regional biomimicry networks all around the world that are applying these solutions locally in their own environments. So it's really taken off.
So as far as consulting, what would you do exactly? I mean, if you went into a business, or if Janine went into a business, would you oversee it? Somebody would have to ask you, how can we apply biomimicry aspects to our business? Is that how it would work?
Well, I think it depends upon the type of business that's looking for some input from the biomimicry perspective. You know, we can apply biomimicry to the built environment. We can apply it within organizations to how they operate. So depending what their goals are, we're going to approach it using the biomimicry process for that particular discipline. So for example, speaking from an architectural standpoint, the way that we start is we look at what functions are we trying to accomplish with our building, with our built environment. So an example of that would be, you know, our buildings are trying to manage temperature, you know, create comfortable environments for us to live within. So we might then go out into nature and say, well, what creatures are doing this here? How are they regulating their temperature? And what can we learn from that? How do we translate those teachings so it can become applied to the built environment?
It really boils down to having a challenge or something you're trying to solve and then asking, how would nature do that thing I'm trying to do?
Right.
And going out into nature and looking.
And there are some fantastic examples on, there are many biomimicry sites, by the way, for people who are listening and want to see some of the imagery. I mean, that's one thing that's very startling about just the extraordinary images of nature that are on all of the sites. But can you talk about some of the examples out there?
Sure. There are some really fascinating examples. One that comes to mind right off the bat is the evolution of wind power and how we are basing the blades of the turbines on the whale fins. And whales can move themselves through water very efficiently without creating drag. So we're looking at the form of those fins and then applying that form to the turbines of our wind power and making that operate more efficiently. So we're essentially saving energy based upon a technology that already exists in nature.
There's another example I've recently been learning about that has to do with wind that I think is quite relevant to New Mexico. We have a lot of wind and the potential for power here. And one of the things that people are concerned about is the big blades that could hurt birds and take up a lot of room in the landscape.
Right.
Well, I've been learning that people are starting to design wind turbines in a way where the turbine itself is more vertical and the blades are more vertical, and they, by putting the windmills very close to one another, echoing, mimicking really how schools of fish work, they're able to use less energy for driving the wind turbine itself and get more wind from that kind of schooling effect, essentially, of putting the windmills, the wind turbines, in close proximity the way a school of fish would. So flocking. There's a story I like to tell that I think is really helps people understand this is the story of the bullet train in Japan, which is a very famous innovation, super, super fast train that would go through the Japanese countryside for commuters and stuff, shaped like a bullet, went super, super fast. Only when it would go from one density of air into another, like in or out of a tunnel, it would create a sonic boom. And that, people didn't like that. So the engineer who was in charge of that project was told to fix it, and he was also a birder. And he went off to his birding meeting, noodling on this problem. What do I do here? And he started thinking about the kingfisher, which is a bird that we have here locally in New Mexico, with a very distinctive shape to its beak. And the kingfisher goes from one density to another, air to water, vertically, without making a splash. And they've evolved that way over its whole life cycle over thousands or billions of years, so that they don't scare their prey away. So he went back and he thought, how could I apply this? And he redesigned the front of the bullet train to be shaped like the kingfisher's beak. And not only did it stop the sonic boom, but the train moves with 15% less energy usage. So that's the kind of thing that's been being done in the world of engineering.
And Ginny Benyus talks a lot about the way that we make things in a human world. She says we heat, beat, and treat. Basically, you know, carving from the top down, 96% waste left over and 4% product. So there's this way of total waste. So in looking to nature, it is this question of efficiency as well. Mm-hmm. That the way that it's been done before is so much more effective that animals basically have to live in their environment, well, all creatures, they can't really destroy it the way we're assuming we can.
Exactly.
And that the point is to live sustainably, right?
That's right. And when you start looking at how the natural world does it, it self-assembles, it builds from the bottom up. Mm-hmm. As you say, there's no waste, there's no high temperatures. And when you look at social systems, which is what I've been studying, there are ways that nature operates that if we started operating that way, things would fundamentally shift. As an example, one of the things life does is it optimizes instead of maximizes. So life is not trying to gather as much as it can and store it, energy, resources. It optimizes to get to grow, to size, to gather what it needs, to use energy just in the way that it's needed. If we started running our businesses or our organizations or thinking about our communities or even our families in that way, things would fundamentally change.
So nature has a budget, just like we have budgets when we design financial and resource budgets. Yet nature is really good at sticking to its budget because it really doesn't have another option, right? An example from the built world is 40% of the materials that we use to build a building goes to the landfill. So we're using 60% of what comes to the site. Well, that nature doesn't have that option. So an example of that, great example I love, is the butterfly, because it embodies a concept that nature uses that we're just starting to really embrace. And it's using form to create a solution or to solve a function rather than applying something. And a butterfly, a good example, is it uses its structure to create color. So the way that it self-assembles, it refracts light, and reflects light and creates the beautiful, brilliant colors without using pigment. And we're starting to apply that concept in the car industry and in the computer industry to make our surfaces more efficient and last a lot longer.
And speaking of surfaces, can you address, there's also this idea of the building surface based on the lotus flower and how water rolls off a lotus petal?
Yeah, that's another innovation that's really starting to be translated from nature into the built environment. And it's a concept called hydrophobicity, which means water on the nano scale has a chemical composition, and when you create these tiny little bumps on a surface, water isn't allowed to adhere to it. So water naturally rolls off the surface just due to gravity, and it pulls dirt particles with it. So we're seeing that technology applied to windows, paints, building exterior surfaces, so we can make a world that is much more clean than it is now. You look at nature, and you know it doesn't have to wash its leaves or its plant stems. It's naturally clean.
Or use toxic chemicals to do it.
Exactly.
Right?
So now, if we can apply that to our world, it's going to make maintaining structures a lot more efficient.
And that really seems to be the goal too. I mean, really picking up on toxic notions. I know neither of you really specialize in food production, but there's a lot in Janine Benyus' first book about food production and how our creation of food is basically doing exactly the opposite. It's making our land less fertile. It's making it less abundant. They're using chemicals, which is actually destroying, poisoning the land. So are there, and have you heard of or deal with people who are trying new ways? You know, here in New Mexico, we have a lot of farmers, and we don't have a lot of water. We need to be really creative with the ways we do that. Do you know of any people who are maybe looking at food production in a different way based on biomimicry principles?
Well, you know, most of us who have small-scale organic gardens in our own backyard,
yep,
and larger-scale organic gardens, are following principles of nature. Those haven't so much been translated into the large agricultural systems. But when we work with building soil, for example, when we create companion planting, when we're addressing the garden or the agricultural fields as if it were an ecosystem, with the biodiversity that's needed, with having the system itself, the different organisms help each other to create the kind of nutrient flows and the kind of water flows and all the things that would happen in the natural world. There's really so much cooperation in nature.
Right.
And we have this idea that nature is competitive. And individual species do compete for mates and things like that, but this idea about nature being so competitive really came from a misinterpretation of Darwin.
Oh, really?
Darwin didn't even say survival of the fittest. That was an economist who looked at Darwin's work and translated into something to kind of support the power structures. What Darwin was talking about was those organisms that are most fit to their environment, that are most able to adapt and fit in with the dynamics that are going on in the environment, that are most able to adapt to changing conditions, are the ones that are most likely to survive. And in fact, when you look at nature and all the different kinds of relationships that there are, most of them are cooperative in nature. And as organisms evolve, they move toward more and more mutualistic relationships, more cooperation going on. And scientists now are discovering all kinds of things that they used to think were competitive relationships actually are cooperative and mutually beneficial. It's very exciting.
Upon further study, realizing that they're all cooperating?
Exactly. Yeah.
I had heard somebody talk even about this tree forest, I think up in in Oregon and that area, where some of the big mother trees in the center were sending nutrients out to the external trees to help support the entire forest. And
that's
I
right.
thought that was so extraordinary.
That's right. The research of, I think her name is Dr. Suzanne Simard, is doing work on that and showing that, again, where we used to think that individual trees and trees, different tree species, were all competing for water and sunlight and nutrients. In fact, they are, the tallest trees are gathering the water and sending it into the soil and banking it deep in the soil for the dry times and then sending it out on their runner roots to other trees, even of other species, far, far away, who need those water molecules, who need that nutrients. And the closer scientists look, the more they see that everybody's talking to each other out there. And there's something we can learn from that.
Well, it seems that our approach so far has really been extracting, destroying, taking our needs, instead of really valuing nature, right? That's what the entire discipline really talks about now. Value it for what you can learn and don't just destroy it. I think even yesterday on Mary Charlotte's show, they were talking about some of the things we've learned from nature. Penicillin, I mean, there are a lot of things we learn from the animals, from the plants. We continue to do so, but we don't seem to do it in a way that also sustains it. It's like, rip every plant out and go and study it. Why are we so slow with this?
You know, I think one of the beautiful things about biomimicry is how people enter into it, why they enter into it, and there are different reasons. You know, it might be that somebody is really technically interested in how a plant or an animal achieves a function, but for me, and I think for a lot of people, it's about reconnecting to place and really understanding the world around you, and if you can understand that, then you value it in a different way. And you have a different relationship to it. You end up with a more codependent relationship, which you know starts to shift our thinking about how we've come through the industrial age, where it's all about heat, beat, and treat, and now we're rolling into an age where it's about cooperation and collaboration.
And do you think that we are entering into this age?
I think we are on the verge of it, whether we like it or not. I think, you know, finally people are acknowledging that there are some issues with the environment that are related to how we treat the environment, and there are starting to be some responses to that and some opportunities in the design world to address those in a creative way.
Yeah. And I find that when I or others turn to the natural world as mentor, it's a different relationship. How I approach somebody that I value as my teacher, mm-hmm. I come with a different kind of humility,
right.
I come with a different kind of respect. I find that in the work that I'm doing with leaders all over the country, more and more I'm hearing people ask, how do I be more adaptable as expectations change, as technologies change, as demands change? How do I have my organization or my work become more resilient? How can we work more in a networked way? How do we collaborate across difference? These are all things that nature does. These are all things that we can learn directly from the natural world.
Can you give us some specific examples about that? Because there's some very kind of concrete examples of mimicking nature in terms of, you know, the burr that became Velcro, the lotus that talks, that collects water, and some other. I mean, they're fantastic examples. But you especially, Toby, are using it in this kind of social way, and I would love to hear really specific examples of how you take these examples of nature and apply it to organizational structure and behavior.
Yeah, this is, you know, I'd say this is kind of the leading edge of this field. So the stories are information as we speak. People are starting to look, and people are starting to ask, and people are starting to apply it. One example that I think is very valuable to learn from is about the U.S. Green Building Council, and this is something Chris is involved with too. These are the people who created LEED certification.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big national organization that ties together folks who do green building. Large national organization with, I think, 80 chapters when they started doing this work, and they were asking, they were becoming very top-down, very bureaucratic, and they were finding that the enthusiasm at the chapter level was starting to wane. So they started looking, how would nature organize a network like this? And they looked at lots of examples from different organisms and different ecosystems, and what they started to turn to as a mentor was something that's called the mycelial network, which is everywhere. And that's kind of a big scientific word, but essentially what it is the fungus that lives in the soil, and the fruit of the fungus are the mushrooms that we see in our own gardens after it rains, or up in the high country when we go looking for the king boletes. Those are the fruit, and the mycelial network, the fungal network that is under those mushrooms, is under the soil. It's connecting all the trees and the shrubs and the plants. It's actually kind of a communication infrastructure. Shares information, shares nutrients, shares resources. And the U.S. Green Building Council started saying, what if we at National started operating more like the mycelial network? And instead of telling everybody else what to do or directing them, we started providing the information and the nutrients to the chapters. We give them what they need so that they can thrive. And it really shifted things. And so there, when they would come together in meetings, there was much more creativity. There was more innovation happening at the local level. There was more interest happening at the local level. That's a kind of example of how we can think differently. And one of the things about the mycelium that I've been learning as a gardener that's really important is the mycelium is providing a lot of the nutrition that the different plants need. And if I go in as a gardener and pump my garden full of fertilizer, I'm actually interrupting that conversation that's going on between the fungus and the plants in my garden. And the fungus goes, okay, I don't need to go over there because that one's handled. So in terms of the question about agriculture, one of the things we need to do is shift our attention from being the doer or like the
manager of everything, because we know better.
Exactly, to helping the helpers.
Yeah, yeah. Now, wasn't mycelium also used to develop the Tokyo subway? Didn't they look at the kind of fungal patterns that indicated where they should develop?
That was actually something else. That was something called a slime mold, which is my totem. I love the slime mold. It's my favorite organism. Get this. I'll just tell a quick story about it. Single-celled amoebas, one cell, that live out there on the forest floor. They don't have eyes. They don't have ears. They're just one cell. And they, but when food gets scarce, they hook up. They send out some kind of chemical signal and speak to each other and say, hey, we got to hook up. And they find each other. They kind of move together, become a slug. And then once they're a slug, they have the mobility to go moving across the forest floor. As they move, they differentiate into different kinds of cells. Some of them become stalks. Some of them become pods. And some of them become spores. They get to a new place where there's more resources. And they go, and send out the spores, single-celled amoebas, to start the whole thing all over again. So they differentiate their work as needed. They come together in an ad hoc way to solve a task, get the job done, and then differentiate themselves again. And in fact, a student of mine in a leadership program who works with a big labor union and has been the main organizer of a campaign for low-wage workers, McDonald's workers and others, to get out to the streets to advocate for higher pay, used the slime mold as an inspiration for how to organize that campaign in a nimble, ad hoc, very flexible kind of way.
That is a fantastic story. And it does seem, yeah, you can add it organizationally and structurally. And I imagine that the same comes from a lot of these inventions here, which is what you're doing. And I will mention that we're not supposed to be hawking a lot of products here. You actually have this set of cards, too, which is wonderful that you've just produced using different creatures. What would you like to describe them before?
Yeah, just very briefly, I've been trying to help leaders and organizations understand how would we work the way nature would. And while, as Chris is talking about, in the built environment and engineering, you have a particular thing you're trying to solve, and you can say, what's that function, how would nature do it? In the social world, it's a little different, and I've been using something that was developed by Biomimicry 3.8 called Life's Principles, which are the 26 ubiquitous things, patterns, ways of operating that all of life does.
Huh.
Things like adapting to changing conditions, being locally attuned, using feedback loops, leveraging cycles. And I developed these cards as a way for people to learn life's principles, find a natural mentor who is embodying that, And then it asks a provocative question about how we can apply that to our own leadership. And I find that it's a helpful way for us to think about what life does out there, and then ask ourselves, well, how can I do that too?
And it's all collected? Are there 26 cards?
There's 52 cards.
Okay.
And, and I have those on my website, and you can order them through biosys@ticktail.com. biosys.ticktail.com. And it's just a fun way to engage with nature. The best way to engage with nature is to get out in it.
But I'm not a biologist. Right?
So. Yeah, right. I'm not a biologist. A lot of people aren't biologists. So sometimes we need a little bit of help translating what's going on out there to what we can learn from and apply as a mentor.
Chris, can you tell us a little bit more about your work as an architect and what you are teaching students here?
Sure. We are working on using a process called biomimicry thinking to inform design solutions. Many times in the world of architecture, we look to precedents around us to help inform future design solutions. So, for example, when we are working on a new project and we go to a site, we do a site analysis. So we start to understand the context of the neighborhood. What do the buildings look like? What are the sun patterns, wind patterns, water patterns on the site? Well, biomimicry brings a whole other level to understanding a site and developing an architectural design response that fits in. And the way that we do that is we actually do an analysis to understand, well, what's living here now? What's it doing? How is it managing water? How is it managing ultraviolet light? How is it managing temperature? All of the same functions that we're trying to solve with a design solution that we present in the built environment. So we'll do an analysis and look at the creatures on the site and try to figure out in a neutral language how is it accomplishing that function. So for example, we can look at, if we're on a site and there's some cacti, you know, we're all familiar with what cacti look like. And cacti are an amazing a creature because it has adapted so well to arid environments, to hot environments where there's limited water, a lot of ultraviolet light. So the spines on the cactus are actually adapted leaves. And they've adapted to this kind of very small, bright-colored point rather than a floppy leaf because that's not going to survive in an arid environment. And those spines are also creating shade. As the sun moves through the sky during the day. So we have an adaptation that is allowing the plant to respirate but also creating shade. And cactus has a body that is flexible, so when it rains, it's allowed to collect that water and puff up really big and hold that water for a long period of time and then start to draw on that resource during the periods of drought. So when we look at, you know, how are we going to design our water systems, we shouldn't necessarily think about it like water's always going to be there. We should think about it like, well, in nature, water's here sporadically in the desert, and we use it and we store it, and then we prolong it over time. So those are the types of things that we'll analyze and kind of create a story about the creatures on that site and how they're responding to these solutions and translating that. How do we translate that to the design world so we can utilize that knowledge?
And how might you translate that? For example, the cacti, how would you translate that into a design model for a house or a building?
So the first thing we're going to do is when we go to a site, we're looking for function, right? So we want to create a design challenge. So let's say in this case it's create shade, okay? We want to create shade to create a comfortable temperature. So we can say, you know, the cactus does this by developing ribs that are circular in nature, so as the sun moves through the sky, its shade patterns are maintaining consistency throughout the day. So then when we go to the built environment, we're going to say, okay, well, maybe we need some vertical fins here, rather than horizontal fins, because as the sun moves throughout the day, it's going to continue to create shade on the surface of the building.
I love that. I want to see more of that. Well, especially here, I think there's so many applications for solar cells. I mean, just look at photosynthesis, right? I mean, it seems that there's so much we can learn from that just in terms of creating light and energy.
That's right, and there are many people now in the world trying to figure out how can we create a solar panel that works the way a leaf does. And so far that code has not fully been cracked.
But people are working
people
on
are
it,
working
right?
On it. Yeah, this is still a very new field.
Yeah, yeah, and that's actually what's incredibly exciting about it, too. I mean, from the very basic to very, very elaborate structures here. And it feels like, in the same way you were saying, we don't really have a lot of choice but to kind of collaborate at this point. We don't have a lot of choice but to really look at what's been working before if we're going to move forward in any kind of sustainable way.
That's
and
right.
I'm not really sure what the other options are, right?
Well, yeah, and if we are trying to live sustainably on this planet, why not do it the way nature does it? It's our mentor. It's directly there, right? Our human cleverness has gotten us into trouble before. And there was a great talk last night that Santa Fe Institute put on by Dr. Tom Lovejoy, a biologist talking about climate change. And his message was, first, how dire the situation actually is, which was quite sobering and motivating. And then his primary message was restoring ecological systems, forests, grasslands, mm-hmm. oceans, even agricultural systems, is a very strong and immediate way to capture carbon. So we've been looking a lot at how we cut emissions, and yes, we need to do that, but also by restoring the biology, we can capture a lot of the carbon that's causing problems right now.
And are there... There's a lot of research around it, but is there also a lot of development happening? I mean, I know I had heard specifically of one big business model, Ray Anderson, who had a huge carpet business, and he applied principles of biomimicry. Do you want to talk about that? Because it seems it's one of the few large industry, and the carpet industry is so toxic and so dirty, and he did find a way to make it profitable and successful.
This is, you're referring to Interface Carpet.
Interface Carpet.
Ray Anderson, who is a real pioneer in the field of sustainability. He died about a year ago, and that was a real loss to us. But his legacy lives on. His company lives on. Interface Carpet has made a zero waste commitment, which is huge for a carpet
Absolutely.
Company. They produce a lot of waste, as Chris was talking about the architectural world. Their number one selling product is a carpet tile called Entropy that they developed after working with Janine and her team at Biomimicry 3.8. They went out into the forest and were asking, how would nature create a floor? And one of the big things in the world of carpet is if you spill a cup of coffee and you make a big stain, you have to pull out the carpet and replace the whole thing. So they are in the carpet tile business. That was something they did towards sustainability. But then when they went out into the forest, they saw that nature doesn't do things in a regular way. It's a little bit more
chaotic.
Right.
And,
leaves fall, sticks fall. It's very... And it's actually quite beautiful. So they designed a carpet tile that had that kind of chaos built in, that had that irregularity built in. So that now... And it's all different kinds of patterns. And that now when you spill a cup of coffee and you just replace that one carpet tile, you don't have to find a tile that matches the color exactly because
right.
there's a randomness in the whole thing. And that's become their number one selling product. So this can be commercially viable out there in the world.
So it's really about changing your thinking. I mean, really saying, no, there's a different way to do it. The way exists, and let's try to adapt to that because it really worked for nature for kind of a long time
That's
until
right.
we came along.
That's right. Exactly. And if people are interested in kind of getting a hit of all the different ways that they can learn from nature, there's a website called asknature.org, which is a database that Biomimicry 3.8 has created where you can look functionally, meaning as Chris has been referring to, what is it that I'm trying to solve, that what is it I'm trying to do and how would nature do that?
Yeah.
And Ask Nature, you can put in your question, how would nature cooperate? How would nature cool? How would nature store water? And find all kinds of natural examples of what's going on out there in the natural world of how that problem has been solved way before us. Everything we're trying to figure out how to do, elegant solutions have come before us through 3.8 billion years of evolution.
And there's a lot of great information on there, especially for teachers. If your teacher's out there listening as well, there's some amazing resources and amazing kind of lessons that you can do with your young people at biomimicry.net, www.biomimicry.net. There's also asknature.org. And Janine Benyus is still, you know, pioneering and having... She has some amazing TED Talks as well that I've seen. And the website's just a font of information. Really, really fun examples, like I said. So I have been speaking with Toby Herzlich and Chris Calori about biomimicry. We will have the information up on the website. This is such a fantastic discipline, and I hope that it spreads. We're going to take a break, and afterwards we're going to be speaking with members of the Youth Media Project, training young people to do radio programs. But thank you two so much for coming today. I hope we get to have extended conversations later on as well.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much, Celie.